Okay, remember when the world was supposed to be flat, where when you lived didn't matter because with email, the internet, you could do business anywhere? Well, our next guest pretty much says, oh, Tom Friedman, that is so 10 years ago. In fact, Berkeley economist Enrico Moretti says the opposite of a flat world has happened. He says there's a sea change going on, a redistribution of population and wealth fueled by innovative companies that need to be in ecosystems to thrive. They need to cluster with like-minded companies in places like Seattle and Boston, where, like beehives, they expand. Moretti says that each new innovative job produces five others in everything from carpentry to teaching. But as these job clusters grow, the rest of the country is shrinking in education, income, even life expectancy. In fact, Professor Moretti says this disparity will be the challenge of the next century. We're going to spend some time with him today. His new book is called The New Geography of Jobs, and he joins us from the University of California at Berkeley. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Have I got this right, that these clusters, they keep attracting other companies even though they compete as well as complement each other?
Yes, you did. If you take a look at the map of the American economy today, you don't see just one country. You see three increasingly different countries. On one end, you have cities like Boston, San Francisco, Austin, or Seattle, with a strong innovation-based economy and a labor force that is one of the most creative and best paid on the globe. At the other extreme, you have cities like Cleveland or Flint or Detroit, with shrinking population and falling wages. And in the middle, there is the rest of the country that seems undecided on which direction to take. Now, these three Americas were not very different from each other in the 1980s and even the 1990s, but have been growing apart for the past 20 years and are now almost different nations.
Well, and one of the striking things about your writing is we can see that in many ways this was sort of a, you'll pardon the phrase, crapshoot. Because back in the day, way back in the day, when the economy depended on manufacturing, cities grew around rivers that they needed for transportation and to power mills. But take Seattle. Seattle's growth may have occurred because of one or two business decisions. Albuquerque may have been Seattle. So explain.
That's right. Everybody associates Microsoft with Seattle, but Microsoft was founded in Albuquerque in the 70s. Seattle in the 70s was in very bad shape, so bad that at some point a sign went up on the freeway saying, the last who leaves Seattle, please turn the lights off.
Well, you're the last one to leave Seattle, turn the lights off. It was by the airport. It was a real sign.
It was. And it's still very much talked about today because it's the sign of a city in decline. But then something happened on January 1st, 79, that changed the fortunes of the two cities forever. Bill Gates wanted to move back near his family, which was in Seattle. And so he moved the entire company. At the time, they had only 15 employees. He moved it to the Puget Sound area near Seattle. And that single episode is the seed that is responsible for the growth of the Seattle high-tech cluster, which now is one of the most impressive in the world.
Because in 1994, Jeff Bezos of Amazon decides to move Amazon from New York to Seattle because that's where he's seeing all these programmers, engineers, venture capitalists clustering because Microsoft is there. And this brings us to phrases you use like thickness and knowledge spillover. What is thickness?
Well, in today's economy, a company's success depends on more than just the quality of its workers. It depends on the entire ecosystem that surrounds it. And an important part of the ecosystem is how thick the labor market in that city is, especially for innovative, specialized occupations like software engineers or computer scientists or biotech engineers. And the reason why thickness matters is because in thick labor market, you have many employers looking for workers and many employees looking for jobs. This allows for a better match between the skills of the workers and the needs of the employers.
So in other words, the fact that you have all these companies, even though, as we say, they do compete, although some do, you know, aid each other. You know, you've got vendors that work with the different companies. But even if they compete, they hire each other's workers at times. They all draw workers. And if one doesn't get a job at one place, they go to another. They share ideas. They become this ecosystem you talked about.
That's right. They become more productive and more creative.
But Professor, just let me ask, haven't companies in effect always clustered? You know, car companies clustered in Detroit. And what was good for GM, was good for the country. But as you're saying, what's good for Seattle and that powerful cluster isn't now necessarily good for the country. So what's different?
50 or 60 years ago, the key predictor of a city economic success was the stock of physical capital. Workers in Detroit were particularly productive because they had amassed a vast amount of physical machinery. They had the best machinery, and therefore they were the most productive workers in their cluster. Today, the key predictor of a city's success is human capital, which means education, ingenuity, and people's skill. My research shows that cities that have many college-educated workers tend to develop an innovation-based economy. And this brings even more well-educated workers there. It's a tipping point dynamic.
Well, just to underscore that, you write that for every manufacturing job, it might produce, I think, 1.6 more jobs. But for every innovative job in either Silicon Valley or the finance district, it might produce 5 other jobs because the salaries for these idea-driven jobs are so much higher. I mean, that seems to be one big difference.
This is the most surprising and possibly most important part of the story. The average American worker will never work for Google or Apple, but the rise of the high-tech and innovation sector matters to all of us. And the reason is that for a community, attracting an innovative company results in significant job gains for workers in the local service sectors, those who are waiters, carpenters, doctors, teachers, and nurses. I call this the multiplier effect. And this multiplier effect is surprisingly large. Take Apple, for example. Apple has 13,000 employees in Cupertino, but it indirectly supports 70,000 additional service jobs in the region, which means that, remarkably, Apple's main effect on the local economy is not in the high-tech sector. It's outside the high-tech sector.
I just want to mention one thing you say about investment. You say that there's a new thinking on the part of private investors. They want to be within 20 miles of companies that they invest in.
That's right. And the reason is that venture capitalists are not just cutting a check and then disappearing, but they want to monitor and they want to foster those startups. And that monitoring and that counseling, that fostering process, it's actually one of the key elements for the success of companies. Google is probably one of the most important ones. And so that's another way in which proximity matters and geography reshapes our local economies.
So innovative clusters attract people with money to invest. They attract workers and create knowledge spillover, as we just heard, wage spillover. They create jobs from hairdressers to lawyers and raise salaries as well. Listeners, are you buying it? Are you living it? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, are you in a city that would like to see it? And Professor, let's pick up there. The clusters you talked about were organic. A tech genius happens to move to Seattle, or a biotech pioneer comes to Boston, all the schools here. We've seen cities try to seed clusters. Rhode Island threw a lot of money at former Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling's video game company, but they're now having to rescue that company. So this is the unsettling part of your book. How do cities replicate these innovative job clusters?
It's really tough because if you look at historically where the innovation cluster are located, almost none of them was created by some deliberate, explicit policy. It's really hard to engineer an innovation cluster. We talk about Seattle, but if you look at a lot of the clusters, they were all born in very random and often serendipitous ways. So it's really hard for policymakers to be able to engineer from scratch.
You know, it's sort of there's no real easy answer to how to reproduce these.
I know, and I frankly think that's
scary.
That's part of it. Yeah. But I think we should be honest about it.
Well, it sounds like what you're trying to say in the book is that you may not have the answers to how cities and towns can reproduce these clusters, but policymakers need to start looking at it because this is, in fact, what the economy is. And with that in mind, I remember recently there was a heartbeat, a pulse in manufacturing, and people have been talking about subsidizing, supporting manufacturing. You even write that, for instance, China has moved one of its factories to Spartanburg because the cost of production was getting too high in Shanghai, which seemed to sort of underscore what supporters of manufacturing are saying, that that it is coming back. But you say what? Is it coming back? Has this idea of innovative clusters completely replaced the old idea of dropping a factory in the middle of nowhere and making widgets?
There is a part of manufacturing that is very innovative, and it's called advanced manufacturing. It makes things that nobody else can make on the planet. And this part is the one that I think we should be focusing on. You know, there are some terrific companies, for example, in Boston that make high-efficient batteries. But the reality is that we're not talking about the typical blue-collar job that people have in mind when you're talking about this type of manufacturing jobs. We lost hundreds of thousands of blue-collar jobs for 30 years. But the number of engineers in the manufacturing sector has actually doubled.
Well, meanwhile, for those blue-collar workers, you talk about this huge chasm between the people who are living lives in these innovative hubs, these clusters, and those blue-collar workers out of work in parts of the country. Huge differences, even in life expectancy. And yet you point out that you know how hard it is for a blue-collar worker to think of picking up stakes and moving to an area that will probably have a much higher cost of living, which these clusters do. And you say an idea might be to give them vouchers to help them to relocate.
That's right. College graduates are very good at finding out job opportunities in other cities and packing and moving. There is recent research that shows that high school graduates are much less able to do so, and high school dropouts even less able to do that. So what I propose in the book is to make part of the unemployment insurance check to make it as in the form of a relocation voucher that helps people who are trapped, not by choice, but by lack of cash, to move to stronger labor markets.
And here's where you also say something that can be kind of controversial. You say that unemployment insurance might actually tie people to a depressed area. I mean, we need to rethink unemployment insurance. But that plays into the hands of people who, you know, think that people are sort of living off the trough of unemployment insurance. You know, let's cut off unemployment insurance to force people to move to more booming, innovative hubs.
Now, let me be clear. I'm saying that if you are in Flint and you are living off an unemployment insurance check, you have no incentive, by the way the program is structured now, to move to, say, Chicago to look for a better job. Your check stays the same, but the cost of living in Chicago is probably twice as high as in Flint.
And your check wouldn't adjust to that.
Exactly. Yeah. And so all I'm saying is that if there's a group of people who are in Flint not by choice, but because they don't have the upfront cash to finance the move to Chicago, I think we could and should think about making part of the unemployment insurance support to mobility. And actually, if you think about it, it would help both those workers who are in Flint and would like to move, but they can't move because they don't have the cash, as well as those workers who don't move and decide to stay in Flint. Because before, you had 1,000 workers looking for a job in Flint with 100 job openings. Now you have, say you were able to relocate 500 of them, now you have 500 workers looking for a job. And so for a fixed number of jobs, even those who stay in Flint are better off.
Enrico Moretti, his new book is The New Geography of Jobs. And by the way, you also point out that these innovative clusters need to be aware that they could also become Detroits.
Absolutely. A recent research that shows that the rise of Silicon Valley as a cluster tracks very closely the rise of Detroit 15 years earlier as a cluster. We shouldn't forget that Detroit used to be the Silicon Valley of its times. But I would say that what really caused the demise of Detroit was its inability to reinvent its cluster when it still had one. And this is probably the key defining difference between Detroit and Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley used to be all chips and semiconductors in the 70s. And then it became all personal computers in the 80s. And then in the 90s, it became branching out, started branching out into digital entertainment and internet and software. And today it's following even newer venue like green tech, nanotech, biotech. So to me, the real sign of a successful cluster is a cluster that is able to keep reinventing itself every time the economic conditions change.
Or as you say in the book, the new product is not a widget or a car, it's an idea, it's a dream.
Exactly.
Yeah. Enrico Moretti, his new book is The New Geography of Jobs. It's not what you do or who you know, it's where you live. To read an excerpt, you can go to hereandnow.org. He's been speaking to us from the University of California, Berkeley, where he is a professor of economics. Enrico, thanks so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.